not enough light?
Yeah, I think so.
See if you can find any Gergums on there.
Yeah, Gregory?
That's my grandfather. Should be two Gregories.
And here's a Gregory, another one.
That's my uncle.
And Clarence.
That's my father.
Oh.
Now, look at the date of that.
Mm-hmm. 1896.
And see what they were receiving per day, not per hour. And how much they got a month?
Let's see, and that pays $60. $2.50 a day?
Yeah, $60 a month.
Oh, a dollar a day for Clarence.
That's my father, and he had 12 children.
Huh.
Well, his wife did.
Good, good.
My mother.
Now, what is this? What family hut?
That's where I came from.
Oh, in New Jersey.
Yeah.
Sandy Hook Treating Ground.
Yeah. Do you want to start this?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Now, what is this? This is the payroll?
Sure.
Huh.
What it says.
And there's 30 people on here.
Yeah.
Huh.
Very small.
Uh-huh.
Look at all that penmanship. You don't see that anymore.
Yeah. Uh-uh.
That's that old Spencerian.
Hmm.
You can set that on the diaphragm,
Okay, I want to get through it.
You want it up or down?
Let's
you want it high, you can put it there, you can put it down there.
Well, if you would mind.
I don't mind.
Okay. Oh. Now, Sandy Hook Prison Ground, that's where your relatives were, Sam?
That's where I was born.
Oh.
So that'll come in the picture if you want me to start talking when you start running it.
Okay, it is.
It is running?
Yeah.
Well, I was born and raised at Sandy Hook Prison Ground. Not raised. I lived there from 1906, which is my date of birth.
Mm-hmm.
Am I talking loud enough?
Mm-hmm.
Until August the 1st, 1919, my dad put the whole family in a car, an old Westcott, and brought us down to Aberdeen Prison Ground, and we moved on to the post. We lived on the post. My dad and my father, my dad and my oldest brother, Ralph, worked for the government at that time, and they came down a year ahead of us and was working on the prison ground 1918. But to go back further, my grandfather was a master mechanic at Watervliet Arsenal in New York City. That's up near Albany, New York. Then he moved to Sandy Hook as a master mechanic of a machine shop. And my dad worked for him. When he retired, he was an inventor, and he retired and was inventing the 6-inch steel gun and the Gergum grease, which is the grease they used in all the weapons. Then he also invented the Gergum pad, which was used by the British. The United States government didn't have any use for it, they said. So he went to England and sold it to them, and they manufactured and used the breech block in their weapons in England, but manufactured by the English. But anyway, he came to Sandy Hook and he was a master mechanic. Then when he retired, my father became master mechanic over a group of men at Sandy Hook Prison Ground. And then when they moved down here to Aberdeen, he was master mechanic at Aberdeen Prison Ground, and my oldest brother Ralph worked under him. And when my dad retired, my oldest brother was master mechanic of the machine shop. So there were three generations of Gergum in charge of the various machine shops at Watervliet, Sandy Hook, and Aberdeen. That's a little bit of the history. But anyway, we were about ready to move down My dad had had a farmhouse on the proving ground fixed up for us to live in. And 2 weeks before we could to move, they had a trench warfare explosion down there, which was high explosive, and our home, future home, was very close to this place that blew up, and it put shells right through the building. It was brick, so we couldn't move. So then he got us a place over on Swan Creek, and we did come down eventually and lived at Swan Creek, and I lived there until I moved to Aberdeen when I married. I married a local girl by the name of Ethel Jimbo. Now, what I remember about Aberdeen is we had two excellent railroads at that time, which you don't have today. The tracks were still here, and the freight trains run. We used to have the B&O, and you could get on a train, on the B&O train, at the B&O station here, ride to New Jersey, up in Jersey City, get off the B&O train, and they had all kinds of buses there, about seven, which would go to different parts of New York City. So whichever section of New York City you planned to stay in, they would take you free of charge. You'd get on these buses, and the buses would take you to, put you on the ferry, and the ferry would ferry you across New York Harbor into New York proper, and they'd take different directions. One go to Brooklyn, one go to Long Island, one would go up upper New York and all over hotels, any place you wanted to go. Then would take the trip back, too. I used to ride the train, my wife and I would, and would go up and see the ball games at Yankee Stadium, Polo Grounds, and the Brooklyn Dodgers over in Ebbets Field. That was back in the olden days. You could make the trip in the morning going up and come back at night and be home by 10 o'clock at night, and you had an extra dinner on the B&O trains at those days. You had good railroads and good meals. I also remember the real old building, and not Route 40, how it used to go across the railroad track and down out Post Road and then come back across the railroad track down here at Swan Creek. That's the way the highway used to run until they built the new road that went straight through without crossing the track. And we used to go to the racetrack over here at Haverdegrace, which had the best horses in the country joined. And we used to have an awful crowd of people come up from Balmer and Washington by car. They used to run trains in too from Baltimore for the race betters in Washington, right into the racetrack. But the cars would come up, they'd come up 40, they'd have to go across the railroad track in Aberdeen, then go down and go through Aberdeen, then go up and go across the railroad track up at Swan Creek, then they'd go across the railroad track again up near the racetrack where you see the industrial park outside of Haverdegrace. Awful lot of traffic considering those days. But then the old stores that we used to have here, like Gibson and Sutcliffe, which was a large department store, W. Adams and Sons, which was a great meat store. And the thing that we liked about Adams grocery store and meat store was that in the morning they had a lady who would get on the phone and she'd phone all the customers that dealt with Adams and say, do you wish anything today? And the wives and the mothers that stayed home knew that they would call and they'd have a list made out. They'd say, yes, I'd like so many bananas, so many of this, so many of that, and so many pounds of meat. Do you have any good pork today? And they'd say, yes. Have you got any fresh chickens? Yes, we have fresh chickens. Of course, in those days, you didn't see the frozen chickens you see today. And how about your eggs? Well, we just got a batch in. A farmer brought in some eggs. And we have some nice looking eggs here, and you'd order a couple dozen eggs. So then the Adams would load all this stuff on a van, a delivery truck, and he'd go around and deliver it to all these people and give them a little tab, showing the bill, what was delivered and how much their total bill was. You didn't have to pay it in those days. You'd just say, charge it. At the end of the month, Adams would send you a bill and then you'd pay your bill. You don't see that anymore. Everyone had credit. Almost everyone. As far as I know, I don't know if anyone didn't have credit in those days. You can go and buy anything you want and just say charge it. Same way with the department store, Gibson Sutcliffe. Then we used to have the coal yard there right near the Pennsylvania River where the cars would come in, they'd go up on a trestle and drop their coal. In the wintertime they would come in there and they'd be frozen. So they'd have to get up there and wait till it thawed out or get picked up there and try to break it loose to get the coal down so they could deliver it to people. You could buy soft coal and you could buy the hard coal. Then they had the scales there to weigh it and they'd deliver it and put it in your basement. You don't see much coal being sold anymore for any of the people to use. And we had the drugstore, which is now Dell's drugstore. I think it was, I'm not sure whether it was called Dell's in those days or not. But it had the old-fashioned ice cream parlor with the little round tables. I guess you don't remember those things. Little round marble top tables with the wicker chairs with all these hooked fancy chairs that you'd bring, sit down and order an ice cream soda, and you'd get these glasses that fit in these metal containers or milkshakes or sundaes and sit there and meet all the people in town. They'd all come down for ice cream at night in the evening. We had a little firehouse in town. Of course, we had our churches, which you still see now. The Methodist Church has put up that new one. Grove's been down there for a good many years. We had the Methodist, and we didn't have a Catholic church there in those days. But they have a nice one now. They used to go down the proving ground, and finally they moved an old barracks out from the proving ground and set it up off of Post Road down in Baldwin Manor and used that as a church for Catholics did until they acquired sufficient money to build their own large church, which they have over here on Law Street. That's basic, I guess. And I've been here ever since. I lived down on Post Road for 20 years and I've been up here for 20 years.
Well, now, when you came to Aberdeen, were the people real friendly here, or what kind of a town was it?
Well, it was very small population, but they were a little bit distant. You know how people are as farming people, and they just didn't seem to mingle with these strangers from out of town until we got in with them, and then very sociable. But in those days, they were a little bit distant, yes. They would call it your farmers. There was a lot of farmers around here. We used to have the, right near the B&O railroad track, we had a big tomato cannery there. And my wife, as a child, used to work over there, and they had corn. They canned corn. Down near the Pennsylvania Railroad, they had a big canning house there. See, Harper County was just full of canning houses. They used to can peas, corn, and tomatoes. And you could smell those tomatoes because you know they'd scald them. And those women would work in there peeling them. Then they'd have all that slop. And same way with corn. And you know how sour corn smells if you've ever smelled it.
Well, now they said that. My impression, Aberdeen was a pretty well-off area. The people around here were pretty
well-to-do. Yes, they were well-to-do, but then it was, I would say that it was family groups. There was a lot of bakers. There was a lot of to the bakers. There's an awful lot of Michaels, awful lot of Michaels, and an awful lot of Mitchells. So those three groups, they practically owned the town. The bakers, they were president of the bank, and the Michaels, they were in the bank, and they owned Kane Good Brokerage Company, which they still had the building still standing down there that they sold to Sis. Sis put up that brick building. They used to run a brokerage house there where they would contract to sell so many cases of corn, they'd charge the farmer or the canner 6% for their commission on the sale of the goods. But they would keep a book for these farmers, like if they wanted to sell a carload of tomatoes or corn. They would sell a farm and they'd credit it to their account. Whenever the farmer won money, he'd just draw off that account and they'd pay him 6% interest, long as it was a credit on the book. Then when the spring came and they needed money, they'd go to the brokerage house and borrow money, and they'd charge them 6% until they got goods for sale. But the grocery stores in those days were very small, and they run the credit business, and so were the dry goods stores. But they were a little distant, so you got to know them well. Then they were building this, what we call the housing project, which is down off Post Road, which the government built for all the people that were coming to the proving ground, because there wasn't enough homes there. In those days, there were the big homes. You still see some of them there. Most of them owned by the Bakers and the Michaels and the Mitchells. I can't think of any other families right at the moment.
Was it a real prosperous time when you came here and all the people, were there lots of people coming to Aberdeen to work?
Oh, yes. Yes, but they had no place to live. That was a big problem. They used to go to Harrisburg, and people would run, they'd run buses, and they used to run a train from the proving ground out here at the Pennsylvania Railroad into the proving ground. They called it the Doodlebug, which all government employees rode free. And they used to have as many 6 or 7 cars, and we couldn't get enough, the government couldn't get enough labor here. So they used to run the trains from Baltimore that would come up and run right into the proving ground and back up in there. And the same way would come from Philadelphia, and they'd come in there and back up into the proving ground. Mm-hmm. And at night they'd go home. Because there was not enough places for people to live in the area then, and they needed work. And they employed considerable, considering the size of the community at that time.
Proving ground,
all
the was it? Could you still see that it was farmland?
Oh yes, my dad on weekends we would get in the car and ride down through the place where they would fire the guns down into the area where the shells would land, and we'd pick apples, we'd pick walnuts, we'd pick all fruit that was growing on these farms which the government took over. The trees were still there. No one took care of them, but we'd still get pretty good fruit off them. But we used to get a lot of apples, and we used to make cider. We had a little old wooden cider press that my dad picked up, and would make our own cider every fall from the apples, and would get walnuts, and then we'd have you ever seen walnuts? They grow about this big, and they're green, and you have to mash them and take the nut itself out of that shell, and that black stuff get on your hand, it'd take 3 or 4 days to get it off. Mm. It wouldn't wash off, just like dye, like German dye, which they used in those days. Mm. Yeah, we used to, it was a farmland.
And now, when you came, was it being built up?
They had built up some, yeah. We were supposed to move into a house which belonged to a farmer, and they had moved it up near the machine shop, and then at the last minute they didn't. Then they were going to put us in this brick house over on the Trench Warfare, which was a farmer's home, and which they put shells to when it blew up. So then they put us in an old building down on the border, down in Swan Creek. Yeah, they were still building it up on a small scale, but when we done our most, our biggest construction at the proving ground, in my opinion, I was working on finance at the time, was what, 1939-40, when World War II started. See, we built up to about 38,000 troops down there. We had a lot of troops there, and we put up a lot of buildings.
Hmm. With the troops? The soldiers and all the construction buildings?
No. I had contractors come in from Philadelphia, New York, and Baltimore.
Hmm.
And any outlying areas that wanted to bid on the contract.
How old were you when you came back
again? Well, let's see, 13.
Hmm.
I was born in 6 and came here in 1990.
So did you go to school here at Concord?
I went to school in Aberdeen, yes, sir.
Hmm. Now, what was that like?
It's a little school. It's still a building used by the county. The Harford County has two or three parks and recreation people, I think, go in there and use it. It's on the road to Harrygrace, on Route 40 there. And it used to be the only school in town. That's where we went to school. Very small.
And were there a lot of people like yourself that were new to the area going there?
Yes. Yes. They would bring us, we'd ride out on a train from the proving ground and then go up there and go to school.
Mm. And how did you decide you wanted to work at the proving ground?
Well, my dad worked, my grandfather worked there, my uncle worked for the government, and my dad worked for the government, my brother worked for the government. And I had a brother who was 2 years older than myself, Gregory, who worked for Washington, D.C., down in the General Accounting Office. He was killed on Saipan. He was in the war. I was the only one of all the boys, and there was seven of us, that didn't serve in the military at one time. All my brothers, they were the right age. I was too young for the First World War I, and I was too old for the Second World War, and then I was married and had two children. But age stopped me first, and then marriage stopped me second, then third, I had two children. That's the way they drafted them in the Second World War. And also I was working for the government, so that's a combination. They didn't draft many people that were needed by the government.
And so where was your first job?
My first job was in the printing plant there. I used to work into blueprints, mm-hmm. developing the blueprints. Then I went into bookkeeping. I went to night school in Baltimore, went to Eaton Burnett Business College, graduated from there, and then went to University of Baltimore for a year, studying accounting. Then I worked for the post exchange. I operated the post exchange at Aberdeen Proving Ground for about 15 years.
Mm.
And then they came to me and asked me if I wouldn't come over and work in the accounts payable branch of the finance department because they were drafting all the people out of there.
Mm.
And I being married and had two children. And they knew I'd kept books there because I'd run the post exchange. I was the buyer, the seller, the janitor. I had one soldier to help me. We only had 200 troops there at that time when I first went in the post exchange.
Hmm.
So we didn't have many troops in those days. That was back in 1929, 30.
And what kind of things did you sell at that time?
At the post exchange?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we sold beer and we sold candy. We sold cigarettes. We sold some parts of underwear, and we sold was shaving material, chewing tobacco, cigars, pipe tobacco. It was interesting. And we even sold women the first rayon hosiery that when that first one came out, we were selling that even. We used to sell a lot of shirts, white shirts for men. When the soldiers go on leave, they were allowed to wear civilian uniforms. We didn't stock shoes or anything like that because you didn't want a large inventory. They had to take inventory every month. But it was a lot of fun. You worked long hours. I'd get up in the morning at 5:30 and I'd get into a little pickup truck that's a premium furnace, the postal change furnace. And I'd go up to the railroad station and pick up the New York Daily News, or not the news, the Times, the Herald, New York Herald, New York Tribune, the Philadelphia Inquirer. There was another Philadelphia paper, the Balmer Sun, the Weiston, big Weiston paper in those days, and the Balmer American, which was put out by Hearst. I'd pick up all those papers. Then I'd go up to the bake shop. We had a bakery where they made their own sweets, and I'd buy 2 or 3 dozen of sweet rolls, donuts and sweet rolls, take them into proving ground. I'd stop at TX and start the coffee, and the soldier would be there then, and he'd keep the place open until I got, and I'd run around and deliver all the newspapers to the military at that time. Then come back and go in and wait on the civilians that used to come in and work there. There was only a couple hundred civilians working there at that time. Mm-hmm. It was very small back in the 30s. Of course, that was by the after the Depression.
Did you feel much of the Depression?
I was allowed to work 3 days a week. I was lucky. I was making money. The government only worked 3 days a week. So I was very fortunate I had a job all during that big Depression. Mm-hmm. But I remember there was a lot of people out of work and the banks all closed. I was lucky I had money in a bank up in Jersey where I put in there before I come down here, and I was able to get a hold of that and kept me a little bit, going a little bit better too.
Did people around
the
Aberdeen suffer much?
Very little, because the proving ground, most of them were working there, or the farmers were working, so there wasn't a, that, no, not around here. They were very fortunate. Went to the city and you saw a lot of it. Strictly civil service. They didn't have all the regulations they have today. Just as Reagan says, they've got regulation upon regulation upon regulation, driving people crazy. When the proving ground was trying to get things going, and I was working for the government at that time, I used to come out to Aberdeen, and I'd see people sitting around, some black people or white. Didn't have any jobs at that time. Was summertime, was slack. I'd say, do you want to work for 6 weeks or for a couple of months? They'd say, sure. I'd say, jump in the back of the truck. I'd take them in, they'd put them on the rolls, and they'd go to work the next day. Today you can't do that. No way. Anyone we hired that way. They had rush jobs and they needed people, and we'd just go out and get them.
What kinds of activities did people do at the
prison?
What jobs were they? Yeah, what were people doing?
Well, most of the people I hired off the street were not trained. Right. They were not real intelligent people, not trained in any specific job. We'd give them a job, maybe they could drive. We'd give them a test to see if they could drive a vehicle. Still wouldn't let them drive a vehicle. Or they'd have them cutting the grass, or they'd have them clean the road, or help them patch up the road, or build a road. And they were always building roads down there, back down all that farm country. They had to build roads down there in those swamps. They'd haul gravel or dirt or anything to fill up the swamps and build roads across where they want them, or build bridges. You know, they do the menial jobs, the jobs that didn't take too much training. Of course, we had the well-trained people who worked in the offices, the white thing, shipping them out all the time. That was the advantage we had of the railroad. If you get down there now, you can still see where we had 12 tracks, where the Pennsylvania Railroad could bring the cars in and store them there, and then the proving ground would pick them up and take them in and put them where they want to put them, or bring stuff out to be shipped out, tanks and guns, and we were shipping them overseas all the time. Same way up Sandy Hook, we used to have a lot of troops up there in World War I. And I used to see a lot of troops around. I'd look out in the harbor, and you'd see a lot of these troop ships out there. Next morning, you'd get up, and they'd all be gone. Because the submarines would be watching for them. They'd have to sneak out, get thrown across the Atlantic Ocean to Europe. Yeah, quite some days, I'll tell you.
Was there any consideration about, like, spies and things like that during these times?
About what?
Like, spying, you know?
Spying? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Most of the spying, of course, the proving ground was very strict in those days. Get in and out of there. You couldn't get in unless you had a pass. And then you couldn't get in the industrial area where they had all the secret stuff. Even I couldn't get in, and I worked as a pencil pusher, white collar job. I couldn't get in unless I had my pass. And you always had to keep your pass out where they could see it. Oh yes, they checked them. Same as they checked them down along the coast there between, you go down to Delaware and go down the coastline to Ocean City, you'll still see those big cement towers up there where you used to watch the submarines, and they used to keep those things guarded all the time, keep people in there to watch to see if anybody was coming ashore from submarines. Yep, they're still there, one or two of them. Oh yes, they had to watch out for spies, and they'd always, that frequently they'd give you lectures on that. You'd have to attend lectures. What you see here, you don't know when you leave. They had to.
Were there lots of secret things going on?
Oh yes, there still is. Yes, the proving ground. Being a research and development organization, they're always having secret stuff. Always.
Well, now, when it moved from Sandy Point first, was it
Sandy Hook?
Sandy Hook. Was it the first thing that they wanted was just for testing? Is it testing the thing?
Yes. See, they used to test up Sandy Hook, and they'd fire across the Atlantic Ocean, which is right near the entrance to New York Harbor. And the shipping people were complaining because they were sending ships over there all the time, because they'd have to block off the area and say no ships allowed in this area. So they felt it was too dangerous. And they wanted a larger area because of the pending war. It was come down here just about the time the war started, and they wanted to test more weapons, so they come down here and bought this piece of land so they could fire down Chesapeake Bay, which didn't have the traffic.
And then now, after that, they got that, then what else came down here?
What else came down with Sandy Hook? Well, we put in Edgewood Arsenal over there where they manufactured gas and gas masks. And they had a field artillery over there, a lot of horses. The horses pulled these little field guns around. Didn't have many tractors in those days like you do today in tanks.
And then when did things like the research and development, those kind of things, when did that start coming to play?
Well, that came down here just as soon as they got the land and got things set up for testing. They'd get the guns in there and start testing. That was before I came down. 1919. They started testing in early 19. We didn't come down until August.
And what kind of industrial things, you mentioned, what was that like? What industrial things were they doing?
Industrial? Did I say anything about industrial?
You said that they that was one area that they didn't allow.
Well, they called it industrial area because that's where they tested all the guns and all the weapons and all the tanks. That's what I said. That was the name for it, the industrial area. It was industry in the weapon line only.
And so now, let's see. Then after your post-exchange, where did you go to?
I went over to finance and worked in the accounts payable branch, which my job then was that they had a bunch group of girls in there, about 10, and we handled all the bills that would be paid by the Aberdeen program. We'd process them, and then they would draw the checks and pay them.
How long did you stay there?
Oh, I was in finance, I guess, 15, 20 years. Then I went into civilian personnel. I worked in personnel 15, 20 years, I guess.
And what did that entail?
Personnel? Well, when I first went in there, I used to handle all the projection programs. And then I get into hiring people, firing people, reprimanding people, counseling people. And I moved around in that, and when I retired, I was handling mostly health insurance, life insurance, and death claims. I'm working on a death claim right now. A widow over here, her husband was a PhD in physics, and he passed away, and she wants some assistance. She didn't know what to do. So I've called the proving ground. They've sent a notice to the Civil Service Commission. They will send correspondence to her, and I will help her prepare all the necessary papers to file her claim. Now, when I did it, when I worked on the proving ground, I used to hear about a death right away. The undertaker would call me, and I would call a member of the family, or I'd tell the undertaker when she came down to pick out the casket and things, tell her that I'm available to help her at any time, any time. Sometimes the widows would call me very quickly because they didn't know anything about finances, didn't know when they'd get any money, and they were upset. And they'd have two or three children around and no money in the house. Wonder how soon they'd get money. I would go out in that case and talk with them and keep in touch with them. Otherwise, I'd say, if you can wait, if it's not upsetting you too much, wait till you get the death certificate, then I'll come out and fill out all the papers and explain all your rights and give a guesstimate, a reasonably close guesstimate of how much money you're going to get and where it's coming from. And your life insurance, your annuity, your children, how much they'll get, and your health insurance, all those sort of things. So that was an interesting job because you were always helping people. And they would call me at home. I'd tell them to call me anytime. I'd give them a phone number. at work or at home. Some of them would just feel concerned. You can understand why a woman who, in those days, the women weren't as well educated in finances as they are today. Because they didn't work, they stayed home, took care of the family.
I guess it sounds like you like that job better than...
By far. By far. The reason I liked it, because I felt that that's the least the government could do, is assist widows, because they know nothing about the government gobbledygook, I call it. It's hard for a person who works for the government as long as I do to understand some of the correspondence they send out. Where for a widow who's never had any contact with the government, she couldn't understand that sort of stuff. No way she could. So I found I was doing a great service to the former employee's widow. And I feel if a man works for the government for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, the least you can do is help his family when he passes on. I think the government owes him that. But they don't do it anymore. They stopped it. I started it, and they stopped it just as soon as I left. Instead of it taking too much time, I didn't feel that way. I took time, sure did. But I would go to some of the widows' homes and spend 3 and 4 hours with them at one time, and then go back more times whenever they wanted me.
Did you have any accidents and things, like, right on the job
or anything? That was the roughest time. One case that I can think of in particular, a big man, he weighed about 275. He must have been close to six, something like that. Three big, heavy man. He's an electrician. And he touched a high voltage wire. That was the end. Nothing to it. So they felt someone should notify the widow. So they asked me if I'd go out and notify them. I said, sure. So I called the chaplain, see if he wouldn't want to go with me. I think one went with me. I'm not sure. But anyway, I went to the lady's home, and she lived on the second floor of an old two-story home. And I went up there, and I had the job, it was my job to tell her. And she was as big a woman, almost as big as he was. She weighed about 250, she was about 6'2" or 6'3". And that woman jumped off that floor. It seemed to me she jumped up to the ceiling. Jumped that high, kept jumping up and down and screaming. It was terrible. Very depressing. Now, I had three daughters, and they didn't like me. Said I shouldn't be doing this kind of work because it's very depressing. Mm-hmm. It is depressing, but I still had a self-satisfaction of helping somebody who need help in the worst way. Mm-hmm. Since I've retired, I go to the citizens and help them. And that's depressing, because some of those people over there, quite a few of them, I knew them personally for years, and here they are nothing but vegetables. So it's depressing, but when I come home, I think, well, I've helped them today. So I go over there and help them with their meals, help them with bingo and that sort of thing, take them around the chair, talk to them, try to make them feel like they still have friends. There's not like friendship when you get older, I'll tell you. When you're young, it don't bother you too much. But when you get older, you just like to think people still think something of you and still want you. I had a government employee call me yesterday. He retired 8 months ago, and he had over 40 years service. And he can't get over that no one that worked at the proving ground that he'd done a lot of favors for has ever contacted him since he's retired. I said, yep, that's true. As long as you're working, can help him, you're a good guy. Just as soon as you leave and you're no longer useful to them, they forget you. That's true in life.
Did you ever feel it was hard to work for a big, you know, the federal government? You were talking a little bit about Nobly Group. Did that ever get to you?
No. No. I enjoyed most of my jobs. I got a lot of pleasure out of it. I was when I was in the finance there, when I had the accounts payable branch, I left that for a couple of years and was a cashier and paid off all the military officers that were there at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And there weren't too many. There was only about 175. Most of them got checked, but there'd be about, I'd say, 100 or more would get cash every month. But I would come out to the bank every payday, but they only paid them once a month in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, I picked up $1 million. Well, of course, in those days, that was an awful lot of money. I had two MPs with me. They offered to carry it. I said, no, let me carry it. I'd like to carry $1 million once. So it was a big mail sack. And I grabbed a hold of those two cords and put it on my shoulder and picked it up and carried it out and put it in the car just to be able to say that I carried $1 million on my back. Of course, today $1 million is nothing hardly. Ball players get $1 million a year. But that was the whole payroll for all the troops and the officers. I didn't pay the troops, but I'd helped count out the money for the troops' payroll because each command officer would come in and pick it up. But then I'd pay the officers in cash. And I knew every officer by his first name. When he'd come in, I'd say, how are you, Tom? And I knew right where he was on the sheet. Most of them first lieutenants and captains, second lieutenants. Not the higher ranks. I usually had to check my uncle.
Did the soldiers being around Aberdeen have much of an effect on the area?
Adverse effect? No. They had a financial effect. No, but I think overall that the troops were better than they are today. You didn't have any trouble with them. There were good troops in those days. You know, in those days, most of them were enlisted men. And they enlisted it for a career. And they were good troops. They would come out of town and go to the movies and spend money in the community. And the community gained by it. And of course, like today, you find a lot of military living out here. And a lot of them have retired and lived here. Got a colonel down there, got a master sergeant there, got a warrant officer over there, a couple of retired officers up there. So, as far as money is concerned, it's really helped the area. If they ever move the proving ground out, bingo, it had affected the whole county. Have to, because their payroll is tremendous. Tremendous payroll for all your civilians. You got 6,000 civilians down there, and 2,000 or 3,000 military. That's a lot of money.
Well, now, do you remember about them building places like around for them to live, for people to live, the spring and then? I guess you had some.
Well, when things started down there on Post Road, between the Post Road and the railroad track, they put in a bunch of cantonments for people to live in as backers.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't for the troops, that was for civilians. And then you started to build homes around.
And what about, like, place like Baldwin Manor, was that built for the
That's what I'm speaking of.
Oh.
That was owned by the Ballin family.
Mm.
And the Ballin family is, Freddie Ballin was a great ball player, one of the best ever raised in this area.
Mm.
And his father was a fur merchant up in Buffalo. And he owned a beautiful home down here.
Mm.
Yep, Ballin Manor. I remember when that whole thing was built, yeah. I lived down there, right near it.
And then that's when, I guess, Aberdeen, did it grow very quickly?
It started expanding slowly, not too quickly now. They like to expand slowly, so they expand without too much riffraff building. Not junk building. Yeah, my brother actually married a girl who came down from Pennsylvania and lived right there in Ballin Manor. She's living with her up here now on Gilbert Road.
Hmm. Now, what about other people that you remember? Are there people around that you remember were at Aberdeen when you came here? You've gone through working with?
Let's see, some people still living here. There's some of the Bakers, like Helen Baker. She's a real estate agent now. She runs a real estate business, rather.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, I remember them. A lot of the Michaels, the Mitchells, the Osbergs. Sure, I remember all them.
Mm-hmm.
See, I've lived in the town myself for a good many years. Since about 27, so I'm 70, almost 75 now, so I've seen a lot of them come and go.
Mm-hmm. What about base managers?
I knew most of them by heart. I was lucky enough to be able to speak to them on a friendly term. Not business, but friends. Well, I think my family name, some of them recognize, because my grandfather hadn't been the inventor. I don't know whether I still have the paper on that or not. I had a paper on it one time. I don't know whether I still have it. Let's see, this is kind of stuff we had down here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, uh-huh. Kind of paper that you put out.
Oh. Huh.
There's quite an article on the first day, you see.
Uh-huh.
Got pictures in there. A lot of people are behind me.
Huh.
There's the commanders, all of them.
Uh-huh.
Now that first one, he came from Sandy Hook.
Oh.
Shoal. S-C-H-U-L-L, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. He came from Sandy Hook. See, at one time, this was the only ordnance post. And so many of the command officers here went on to be chief of ordnance.
Oh.
And chief of ordnance is no longer. There's no longer such thing as ordnance.
Mm-hmm.
And Phillips, they named Philip Steele after him. The airfield, yeah. Chaffin had a great signature. And Rose, I used to play tennis with some of these guys. And there's Bull Weston and Tinkle. He had two boys. I used to play with his son. Quinton was a ladies' man. I mean ladies, man, that boy was. Keith, Harris, and Vincent. I was a personal friend of his because my first name's Vincent. His name was Vincent. We'd always kid each other.
Huh.
Yep, I know every one of them.
Hmm.
And Weber, there's another ladies' man. Boy, he was a ladies' man. He was my boss in the post exchange as the second lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of proving ground right there.
Mm-hmm.
See that page 3 there with all that mud that they were working in, trying to put up those cantonments, those barracks?
Do you remember what, did it, was it like, really like that?
Oh, hell yeah.
Huh.
Oh, yeah. I remember.
It must have been a really not developed place at all. It must have been really wild.
It was wild. Well, it was farmland.
Hmm.
See, all that was farmland.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reason they were able to get it. Nothing but farmland.
Hmm.
And look at the depot there.
Mm-hmm.
There's the general's command officer's home. That's still sitting. That's an old farmhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Now this fellow Beale and company, I remember, I know the whole family, they still run their business there.
Mm-hmm.
See those quarters there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that their home?
That's the command officer's home, yeah.
Uh-huh.
That was formerly an old farmhouse, and they had another wing on it for the help. They had the little piece on the side there, but that's a farmhouse.
Huh.
See, it was all farmland around there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it had this Joseph Sleeper. Did you know him?
Oh, yes, I know his family. He had a son, Joe, and he has a daughter that still lives around here, I think, down there, lives in the trailer park.
Hmm. Is she still living?
She's still living, I'm pretty sure.
But how about him?
Oh, Joe?
Yeah.
Joe's in real bad shape.
Oh.
Joe's quite old.
Oh.
Look at that old building there, the post building on page 9. That's the headquarters building, and that's still sitting there.
Hmm.
That thing was built for 5-year usage when it was put up. And I worked in there for many a day. Many a day there. Yeah, I remember all that mud. Of course, we kids love that. Thank you.
Now, Ralph Burnham, was that your father?
That's my brother.
Your brother, yeah.
Yeah. I remember the YMCA building. I think that's the one they moved out for the Catholic Church.
Hmm.
His wife's still living.
Were there a lot of people that came from New Jersey?
Yeah, there was quite a few. I'd say maybe 50,
mm-hmm.
50, maybe 75 at the most.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are deceased now.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, Ralph Burnham, Tomasky, he's deceased. A lot of those guys are gone.
Did you have visiting dignitaries and VIPs very often?
Always. Always. Place was full of them.
Huh.
Well, you see, it was on the ordnance post. It was on the research and development on the ordnance field and the testing and evaluation. We had the BRL Institute there, which was great, it's still great, but it's not near, I don't think it's as great as it used to be. Sure. They always had the dignitaries, and they'd spend a barrel of money because they'd bring all the congressmen there.
Oh.
And they'd dress up the post, they'd clean it up, they'd have troops walking down the road to pick up every piece of paper, cigarette butt, anything laying around, clean everything up. All the troops were out early in the morning doing it. And they'd have all these congressmen come in, and then they'd put on a big display for them so they could get more money to do more research. It was a selling point. And they'd treat them like they were kings. Talk about treating them VIP.
Mm-hmm.
It was terrific.
would you ever have a president?
Yes.
Did you?
Oh, sure.
Huh.
I think Truman. One of them come up the Chesapeake Bay in a boat one time. And they came there to see a display, see some special test that he wanted to see. And you talk about preparation for that. Yeah, we've had presidents there. Your old Joe Tidings, the elderly gentleman,
mm-hmm.
he was a great senator. And he done more for Aberdeen Proving Ground than anyone ever did.
Hmm.
He was always getting the money. He used to live over here in Oakington, which is the biggest state. It was used one time for a training school, and it was also used by a fellow by the name of White, who was a theater man. I think he produced Broadway shows. And back in those days, the theaters weren't open on Sunday. And on Saturday night, he'd get on a train with a bunch of chorus girls from New York that were in shows, bring them down on the train and go over to Oakington. They'd have a big party over there. I mean, a big blowout. And there was a shooting there one time. I think he was shot. I forget which now. But that sort of slowed that thing down. Then Senator Tidings bought it. And he lived there, and then his boy Joe ran for senator and was elected, but wasn't re-elected. He's out of office now. But Joe Tidings was very friendly with both Bob and John Kennedy. He helped to move up the ladder on their coattails. They used to come over there and play tennis quite frequently. They'd fly up.
Hmm.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine that they would have been good kids, huh?
Yeah. They like to play tennis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quiet and peaceful over there.
Hmm.
Out in the country.
Hmm.
Yeah, talk about your VIPs. We've had plenty of them. And then J.P. Morgan owned the Sooty Island, which is the other end of the Proving Ground.
Mm-hmm.
And J.P. Morgan had his own special car on the railroad because he practically owned the Pennsylvania Railroad in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And he used to have it hooked onto an express train. And they'd leave New York, come down to Aberdeen and stop, let him off, and then John Smith, who was the only automobile dealer in town, and he dealt in Fords and Lincolns, that's all they sold. He'd have his Lincoln down there all shined up with a colored man to drive it, and would drive J.P. Morgan down the Proving Ground and take him down the end of the Proving Ground. Then he'd take a ferry across the Sooty Island, and he had this big home over there.
Mm.
Home's still there, but I think it's burnt down finally.
Mm.
But he owned that and used to use it for duck hunting. He used to have a lot of big wheels come down there and go duck hunting off the island. They'd kill ducks right and left. By the hundreds. Of course, there was no limit in those days, and they wouldn't shoot anything but canvasbacks. made it full with these under stuff. That sink box. You know what sink box in there, don't you?
What is it?
It was a box with flaps on the side to keep the waves from washing over. They'd put them out there and then put a couple hundred decoys around it. Then they'd take the people over there and they'd sit down there almost like a coffin. You'd lie down there on your back with your gun alongside of you, your shotgun. And then when the ducks would come in, you'd lie real quiet. And then when they get almost on you, you'd jump up there and boom, boom, boom. Slaughter. Then a man would come from the boat, which is a mile away, maybe a half mile. They'd come and pick up the dead ducks and they'd lie down there again, wait for. But they'd only stay out there an hour or two because it was too cold. See, the thing they were lying in would be down the water because this thing was flat, right level with the water, and those flaps kept the waves from washing water in where you were lying. They used to do an awful lot of that around here. All the big hunters used to come down from New York. They'd take them back and have a big party. They'd kill 200 or 300 ducks and they'd bite 200 or 300 people and have a big Camelback duck dinner. People with money. Plenty of money. Like the racetrack people, they used to have a lot of money coming here too. All come down from New York. But New York tracks didn't run all the time like they do now. Well, I don't know whether I've told you anything or not, but what you're looking for. I've had a good life. I have no complaints.
What?
I had a good wife and good children.
That's very interesting. Could you suggest any other people that you worked with or that you know around Aberdeen that might be a good person?
Well, at Aberdeen or at Haverly, too?
Either.
Well, it's a Pierce Thompson that worked at the Proving Ground. He's still living over in Haverly Grace. His picture's in this paper. He's a tall, skinny guy. He's a pretty smart guy, too. I always thought he was. Let me see if I... Always falling.
Oh, yes, there it is. I see his name.
What's his name on here?
It's down at the bottom.
Yeah, Pierce R. Thompson. Let's see if I can pick some more out of here.
Well, you were talking about the Mitchells and the Osborns and the Bakers and the Michaels. Are any of them, older citizens that might be a good person to talk to?
Let's see. Well, you see, there's an Osborn lives next door to me, but he's a young chap. He wouldn't know anything. And his grandfather's deceased, and his grandmother just passed away. His grandmother could remember a lot. They're in the canyon, they raise corn. They have, you notice on Route 40 when you go to Haverly Grace, there's a big cannon house along the railroad track. C.B. Osborn, that's them. He's the son. Now his father's living, but his father's younger than I am. Now, whether how much he could tell you, I don't know. Charlie B. Osborn, you might want to consider him. Let's see, of the Bakers. Give me your name and phone number, and I'll try to see what I can come up with. How about that? All right, if you'll write your name down and your phone number down, I'll work on it.